Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We've sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them in with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organization that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them. Links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
So welcome everyone to our panel today. Our panel is on trauma, ecology, and social change. And we have three incredible guests today. I'm going to start with Joshua. Joshua has been involved in somatic experiencing since 2004. He has studied the nervous system regulation and has incorporated inquiry into many disparate fields, including ecology, philosophy, and neurobiology. He holds an MA in clinical psychology with emphasis in somatic psychology. He also has a PhD in higher learning and social change, and additionally is a licensed marriage and family therapist. We also have Matthew with us today, and Matthew is a somatic movement specialist. His command of embodiment ranges from anatomic detail to interpersonal communication. He uniquely integrates scientific, therapeutic, philosophic, and artistic disciplines. And we also have with us Amber Elizabeth Gray, and Amber is a human rights psychotherapist, a dance movement therapist, a continuum teacher, and the originator of restorative movement psychotherapy, and the co-originator of polyvagal-informed movement therapies. Welcome to our incredible panel today. As we start, I think the big question that's on everyone's mind is, what is the purpose of trauma in an ecosystem? I think to kick off this panel, it'd be great to know about that relation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I want to jump in right off the bat, if I may. And throw in something that's been on my mind that it might come up. I'm just gonna put it out there right at the beginning. And this comes from Stephen Herod Buhner, who's just a fascinating consciousness researcher and ecologist. He deals with plants, he deals with psychology, and he deals with the metaphysical background of the world. Like, what is the meaning in things? And so he always asks this question, what is the purpose of whatever in the ecosystem? And he, among those, he asks, what is the purpose of humans in the ecosystem? And one of the most outlandish answers I've ever heard in my life comes from him. And I cannot come up with a reason it's not right, which is that the purpose of humans in the ecosystem is to be Gaia, Gaia's reproductive system, the reproductive system of the whole living Earth. And what I love so much about this answer, whether it's true or false, it doesn't even matter. It gave me a context to go, oh, I'm doing it right. All our rockets look like flower parts. Our lunar lander looks like flower parts. We send viruses and bacteria off into outer space, and they are the building blocks of Gaia. So here we are sending these things off planet, and maybe we're doing it right, using up all the energy the Earth has to offer, just like a plant would when it flowers, going into this flourishing of energy. And here we are so worried that we're going to use it all up, and we will. It's a real problem for us as humans. But what a reframe to go, huh, maybe we're doing it right. This is our purpose as an organ of the Earth. And so the purpose of trauma to me in the ecosystem is like the trouble we keep tripping over until we can figure it out. Like, it's to be the wall that it's like, oh, I can't And then we get curious and go, what's going on here? And start looking around a little deeper. So I guess that's my frame of what trauma is in the ecosystem. It's the tripping point. It's that, like, oh, it's so annoying. God, I'm so frustrated. And, huh, that's what I got.
I'll jump in after that. I want to start by saying that I think trauma as a term, as I'm sitting with this question, it's such, and I think an overused and often understood, or just, it's become a bit of a buzzword. But so when I think of trauma in this context of the ecosystem, I think of big change. I think of change. And one of the things that I say to my clients all the time, who are refugees, mostly political, but increasingly more climate change refugees, you know, that one of the things, the questions that I often get is, well, you know, will I go back to the same? Will I go back to normal, whatever that is? And I always say, trauma is life-changing, forever life-changing. It's not about good or bad, better or worse. It's a change. It's there are imprints that are created. So when I think about the ecosystem, I think about traumatic events, how, whatever they may be, whether they're human caused, natural disasters, as an opportunity for change. Humans, I think, just because of how and who we are, can get attached in a way that I imagine Mother Nature and Gaia do not. So I think the change is probably less loaded in terms of ecosystem. My heart breaks when I see things happening, you know, mass extinctions, things like that. I also think it gets folded into the layers of change that always are part of ecosystem. And I'll pause there.
Sorry, Joshua, I don't think we can quite hear you. Alrighty, I will let, there you go.
Hello.
There you go.
Huh, so not sure what happened. I'm gonna try to plug my headset back in. But
can you hear me now?
Mm-hmm. We can.
Okay, great. So I was just saying that the for anybody who was just arriving, the question was, what is the purpose of trauma in the ecosystem? Is that right? And you know, I Peter Levine, the developer of somatic experiencing, you know, he said something that I've seen to be true, which is that trauma seems to be an artifact of the domestication experience. You know, that we see humans and our domesticated animals as the entities that seem to develop traumatic reactions. And ethologists that study animals in the wild don't seem to see a whole lot of trauma. Wild animals seem to have a natural immunity to trauma. And in that, I like to recognize this distinction between, you know, we were talking about, like, Amber, I think one of your questions had to do with movement as a connection to the wild world, you know, and to make sure that there's a clear distinction between wildness and civilization, domestication, and that domesticated life and civilization is not an ecosystem. You know, it's a system, it's a complex system, but it's now been unchained from, you know, billions of years of evolution and all of these natural forces that have honed ecosystems into places where life thrives. And I think of trauma very much as an artifact of the movement that humans have potentiated out of that and into a really untested and alien and actually pretty bizarre way of life that we call industrial civilization.
I'm wondering if perhaps we can move into Amber's question and talk about that impact on movement and how it offers connection to the wild world, because I think that's an incredible segue that you just made.
Did you have thoughts about that, Amber?
I was thinking, since it was my question, I wouldn't answer it, but sure. So the original question was, how does movement offer connection to the wild world? And one of the things, I actually arrived at the question today while I was watching the surf. I'm not at home right now. I'm in South Padre Island, Texas, because I needed to be near the ocean. So lots of movement. When I think of human movement, which is actually what I was thinking of, I was thinking of how anytime we move, anytime there's the tiniest movement, there's a neurological response. We start to, we access the neurological underpinnings of everything we are in our bodies, thoughts, feelings, actions, everything. And I was also thinking of movement as memory, and how in human movement, there is every moment of our personal development. My work is influenced by body mind centering, also continuum. But the way that we move, and we might not remember it in a conscious way, but every movement trails back to some pattern, some pre-pattern movement, some very early exploratory movement. And then also the movement of our evolutionary ancestors, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, the whole evolutionary pathway that gifted us life. I mean, I always say we owe our lives to them, and it's not like we're at the end of a pathway. We're still living and breathing all of it. It's a constant spiraling infinity shape movement that's inside of us. So as we move, I think we can also, I know through my own body that we can connect to those memories as they live and breathe inside of us. Jellyfish breathing, fish swimming, whatever it is, crawling, belly on the earth. So I'll leave it there. Someone else to pick up.
So appreciated watching Matthew move at the beginning of this, that wild, spirited dance. Felt a little jealous. I wish I had the space to stretch out and move around like that. I think so much about these bodies and the movements that we were generated to produce. And, sometimes, do the meditation on our hands, and how this is pretty much precisely the diameter of a branch that could hold the weight of our bodies, And so we're built for this particular kind of life. And, our arboreal ancestors, that have lived through us in these ways. Not to be negative, but sometimes I'll reflect on the movements that, or the lack of movements more specifically, that my body often makes in my modern life, and it's a little bit of a of a travesty, the sitting in these devices, that our bodies just aren't intended for. When some part of our bodies is probably yearning for more of this free expression, that channels all of those life forms that preceded us.
This piece you speak to, Joshua, about the travesty of our modern life, about, here I am swatting white flies, it's real. And yet we don't have to accept it. We don't have to live that way. And I suppose I live on that side of the play of like, I'm a dancer first and a therapist after that. But my nature is as a dancer. And so the wild, when we ask what is wild? I mean, wild is kind of the unpredictability to me. It is, what is nature? I am nature. I'm a participant in nature. I am made of nature. I am nature. And nature is a lot that isn't me. So nature is this computer system we've got that allows us to meet. But it's that, what an odd form of nature. Like we would say, that's not nature. And yet, it is a piece of nature. And actually, the system that we're using is a lot like a mycelial network. It's incredibly like a mycelial network. And we choose where these pathways of connection happen in that. So I really love this question about, you know, where does nature, how do we use the body to be me? I'm going to change the question. How do we use the body to be nature? Because we already are nature. But where's our access point to that? And so somatics is this field that studies awareness and motion, motion and awareness, and this feedback loop. And so rolling on the floor is one of the fundamentals to me, because it's from a BMC point of view, this is how babies learn to move. From a Laban point of view, this is how we can find our spatial network. We can yield and soften into the floor, and we are supported by Mama Gaia. And so that yielding process, and from an ecosomatic point of view, yielding, if we think of it in permaculture, which is a system that studies how living systems, how human design systems can imitate living systems. So yielding in permaculture is to harvest. So I harvest gravity by yielding into the floor, and then I can do something with it to get up. So that, whether you call that a push, you know, a yield and push from Laban/BMC, or in a permaculture point of view, I harvested gravity in order to take my action, my voluntary action, to come up, and I am supported. So I think when we think of ourselves as nature, and then start asking questions about what we want, what are we trying to do with that nature, then some of the problems shift. My problem personally isn't so much that I don't get to move how I want. It ends up being more, how do I interact with a culture that otherwise chooses not to do that? I'm the weirdo who gets up and starts dancing in the beginning, and I'm like, I'm being weird. But it's also important to get to see each other in that motion and challenge these societal norms that would say that I should be staring at the screen. It's a funny challenge, but it's like, what happens when we bite it off and say, I'm willing to be unpredictable, I'm willing to be wild? Contact improv being the next takeoff point, but I think I've spoken enough. So maybe I'll save that for another question. Thank you so much.
Fantastic. I think some of the things that were coming up were this idea that nature is unpredictable. And that can look like a variety of different things, whether it's a environmental disaster or some of the vicious cycles that occur at different points in the years in different climates. And what I'm kind of thinking about is, perhaps you might want to share some of the impacts of collective trauma on our ecological system, and really define for the audience what collective trauma is, what it looks like for you, and how this is showing up in your lives, perhaps.
I'll go. Collective trauma, I'm just going to preface it with my sense of how the word trauma has become a bit of a buzzword. And I was thinking about this question today in preparation for the panel. I think of it as, because I've done a lot of community work, a lot of disaster work, working in active conflict zones, as well as coming into complex humanitarian emergencies post-conflict. And I think of collective trauma as possibly in a community, I'm just gonna use the term community, when enough people are truly traumatized, not speculative trauma, which happens a lot in disasters and complex humanitarian emergencies. People think that everybody is traumatized, and I have actually witnessed that not everybody is. That's true of refugees and asylum seekers and my clients who come here as well. But when enough members of the community are experiencing loss, grief, trauma, fear, all the sort of facets of what might be part of trauma, that can be a collective trauma, because, you know, it's the, it's David Bohm's implicate and explicate order, which is, I mean, I'm not a physicist, or the micro and the macro. It's going to affect the collective. It's going to affect the society. It's going to affect the community. And also I've been in experiences where an entire community, I'm thinking of the tsunami of 2000, that was 2005, and how entire communities were wiped out. It wasn't necessarily trauma in some communities. It was more of a collective loss or collective grief, but where there's a clear impact on the entire community. And so there's a collective suffering or a collective an experience. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're accustomed to thinking of trauma in terms of the individual biological system, but, you know, and thinking in terms of these fractals, you know, one of the one of the other systems that our individual system participates in are these larger collectives, you know, be they partnerships or families or neighborhoods or communities or cultures, countries, and you know, our belonging in those larger systems means that what affects those systems, you know, also affects us as individuals. And so you can see how things that impact larger systems that we are a part of also live in us. And so we will sometimes have impacts from larger events, things that happen to our communities and to our cultures. And as people go through that together, you know, there can be effects. And sometimes, you know, Rebecca Solnit's work, you know, has looked at disaster utopias and the ways that some of these collective challenges that we go through actually facilitate people coming together in really meaningful ways. And so, you know, I tend to try to reserve the term trauma for, you know, not just an extreme event, but something that creates the symptoms, you know, that we think of as trauma. So might be that we could think of disasters, you know, not necessarily as traumas, because sometimes what happens is communities come together and become more cohesive, and people get a taste of what human life might, hesitate to say it's supposed to be, but maybe a little bit more what we're designed for, you know, which is this experience of togetherness through adversity.
The piece that's coming up for me is that we don't create or heal our traumas alone, and that can be trauma with a lowercase t or an uppercase T, but that, like, it doesn't happen alone. Either way, we do it together. And so then I'm led to ask, what are all the things we do together that when we create this collective coherence, the field of consensus, which has everything to do with the relationship of consent, then we can be drawn to believe something's right that may not feel right from the inside, or that we may be given no choice about. Like, one definition of trauma, or one way I think of trauma, comes through as this, like, the thing that's been done to me that I can't choose otherwise. It happened and I tried to stop it and I couldn't, and then a trauma pattern might form. That version of the story. Take, for example, male circumcision. Our culture assumes it. I mean, it's just the norm. I grew up Jewish. It was boom, from 7 days old. I never got a choice. Turns out that actually really screws up our sexuality. There's great arguments for saying this has huge implications for what the masculine represents in our culture, that there's this thing that as men we're trying to get that's not available because all those sensory endings were just clipped off when we were born. And it's wild when you go through that rabbit hole. It's like, whoa, but of course we do that. But why of course? So all these things where it's like, well, of course we do that. Of course we don't ever grow food. We go to a supermarket. Of course we, all these of courses, like this is just how we do it. They can create a collective dynamic that may not be coherent on a certain level. And so I guess that's kind of what I hold when I think about collective trauma. I'm like, oh, the things we just don't even notice. There are shadows that are so quiet, but we keep tripping over them. So you know, this coming back to circumcision, it's like, well, why are men having trouble with this or that? I don't want to go too deep into that. But you can see all the tripping points, Viagra, blah, 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 blah. There's tripping points. And we all hit them and we think it's the norm.
I think that's a good point, is really looking at challenging some of those norms. And I really want to go back to something that Joshua said in regards to communities coming together in light of natural disasters. And I wanted to look at the other side of this in terms of how can nature and environment be beneficial for trauma healing? When we're stuck in some of those patterns that Matthew mentioned, what can people do to really get that connection?
I mean, before diving into somatics, I was involved in what's called the eco-psychology world, really looking at the healing power of nature. And I very much think of my worldview as an ecological worldview. And part of that is this recognition that we're designed, we come into this world, I think, expecting relationship with a rich biosphere, you know, and a community of others. You know, our ancestors had this incredible, like, taxonomy, a taxonomical understanding, you know, dozens, sometimes hundreds of plants that they knew intimately and understood how to use as food or medicine. And you know, reverential relationships with animals that, you know, were painted on cave walls and understood as kin and woven into mythological structures that outlined our, you know, their significance and our sense of interconnection. And you know, that's that our psyche is prepared for that. And I would argue that our psyche needs that. You know, there's now a lot of scientific data on the healing power of nature. Everything from, you know, how viewing natural landscapes leads to states of well-being, taking walks in nature versus taking walks in the city is, you know, perceived as more restorative and beneficial. And even now, you know, they're doing work in laboratories with the essential compounds within like things like cedar trees, and how those seem to have neurological effects that potentiate feelings of, you know, well-being. So, you know, now it's like, oh, okay, thanks science. You've let us know that nature has beneficial effects. But I think it's just very much part of who we are.
I agree with all of that. And it's interesting because what I am thinking of is communities coming together. A couple, when I responded to the tsunami or in Southeast Asia or to the earthquake in Haiti, which were natural disasters, which was, and I'm going to call it an upset by the earth. So that, you know, observing how the relationship to earth itself was for many people shattered or upset or stressed. And I actually want to backpedal just a moment. This is something that I said before about trauma that I witnessed in Sumatra, in Aceh, which is where I worked post-tsunami, and the whole question of trauma. Because when I went there, there was an assumption by everybody who knew me that there was going to be a lot of trauma. And there had been a lot of clinicians from Europe and all over coming in and doing simple PTSD scales and telling everybody they were traumatized and needed a, you know, particular kind of behavioral approach. And what I witnessed and experienced was not trauma. It was this collective sense of loss or grief and the community coming together, which you mentioned people really, much of it had to do with Islam, with that particular very old, very communal Islam there. But people really understood what had happened. And there was a very clear reason for everything that was going on. So it wasn't trauma at all. It was loss. And then here's what we need to do. And some of that was about repairing relationship to nature. So coming back to this question, it was a coastal community, a lot of fisher people, boats destroyed, and there was a really clear sense that part of the action that needed to be taken was how do we understand, the ocean's part in this, and how do we return quickly to the ocean? And it was, people were just like, we have to get back on our boats. We have to rebuild them. We have to get back out and fish again. All the things that they naturally did. I was just listening to different people so that they could reconnect to nature, reconnect to the ocean, reconnect to the bounty of the ocean. So it was a very conscious decision to remember how ocean, which is, part of Earth, it's a very significant part of Earth, ocean's place in their whole landscape and in their economy and in their community, and how to reconnect to that.
I'm wondering if I could hear the question again, because I've been just listening into these answers and now I've got like 10 things, but I would love to be on point with the question.
So I actually feel the same way. I think the question has been so diverse. I think we're looking at the terms of when we're working with community, how can we go back to healing from nature? How can we go back to using our ecosystem to heal from a mass trauma?
Touch each other is what comes up for me. Dance with each other, move together, circle and speak from the heart. My friend Mark's here. Would you be up for dancing a little bit?
Yes.
Cool. Come on in. So I hold community space here, ecstatic dance, contact improvisation. And really, it's like this, just where do we reposition ourselves with each other? Where are we willing to be? And then if that's not the right place, then noticing the voluntary nature and having the trust that the other person will take care of themselves. And that's huge, because if we're worried that they won't, then we're going to try to prescribe what happens. We don't get the wildness. So there's trying to find out what are the collective agreements, even in a dyad, the consent and the consensus that forms in a group. And I think it's massively healing just to be with each other. And the intimacy, which is terrifying. Like, I saw a question in the chat that had to do with courage. And it's like, I call the work that happens in this place where I am brave space, because it's not safe. Like, we're gonna get hurt sometimes. But if a place is too safe, then it's lost its wildness. And that place really is the place of our hearts and connection. And yeah, the depth of intimacy, and to find that in our bodies with each other, to be able to sense each other and stay ourselves as we do it, right? And that's the consent aspect, that's the repositioning. I'm still me, I don't owe this person anything, I choose to be here. Where do I choose to be? And so again, we are nature. So we can do the same thing with a tree. We can do the same thing with the ocean. We can do the same thing walking just through the air, but it's really special with another human being. because we speak the same language as we do with parts of nature. We can learn, you know, shamanistic traditions are really, really good at speaking the language of nature as a human and listening to it, listening to the collective that's bigger than the humans. I don't know how linear that was, but, you know, feels true.
It feels true to me as well. I was following, and I think based on the chat we're hearing, that sounds like a very nice and a great experience to do. And I'm wondering if any of our other panelists would also like to speak to the idea of courage and resilience, either when speaking to environmental disasters or in general throughout your field.
Okay. I was actually looking back at the question, because the question, which is I can't see anymore, was around courage and something about instead of looking at a screen rolling and moving. And I think when I looked at that particular question, I thought, well, you know, rolling and moving is so natural. I mean, one of the things sometimes my work will take the form of staff support, which is actually supporting organizations. You know, it's like the organizational expression of self-care. And I'll be working with CEOs or boards of directors and strategic planning. And there'll be times where I'll have everybody out, you know, we'll go out and we'll actually have to roll down a hill. It's like, it's so natural to roll or to ooze or to slime mold, as I like to call it, to sound, to be in response to sounding that we're making. So I guess I'm sitting with it, so seems so natural, and we do grow away from it in this idea of growing up. I always say I refuse to grow up, I just keep growing in. So that I can come out in more authentic and reflective ways. So I've never thought of it in terms of courage. And since that is the question, I think, if I'm accessing any courage in my being somebody who does do a lot of rolling around and slime molding on the floor, which I can't do because I'm in a tiny little hotel room right now. I think it comes from a deep interoceptive listening. The more we develop the capacity to do that self-listening, that deep reflection, interoception, quiet the exteroceptive input that's now become a constant exteroceptive bombardment, whether it's, you know, gamma rays or all the EMFs or just the sound of the busyness of the world and everything going on. I think that's where I source courage from and encourage my clients to in many, many different ways.
Yeah, I don't know if anything needs to be added. I think a lot about resilience, and in the training that I do, we talk about resilience, but we use the term specifically to refer to it in the way that people who work with physiology do, which is the capacity to return to baseline after stress. So it's not so much an ability to weather the storm or, you know, to rebound, but to see how biological systems can come back into some quality of coherence after the input of increased energy. And I think that, you know, so much of trauma is a disruption in that capacity, where we end up living in states of high activation, distress, disorder of some kind, maybe more of a freeze shutdown response, but something that's stuck and doesn't really fully allow us to come back into a place of settling where we're oriented to our environment and ready to engage. So I know that for myself, getting back that resilience equipped me with a tremendous amount of courage, you know, being able to trust that my system can go into states of high arousal, and that I'll easily be able to, you know, surf that wave and come down the other side, as opposed to, you know, the situation that often shows up when we are traumatized, you know, where we get activated and then we just stay activated, or we, like, you know, end up living in a kind of feeling of being disconnected from the world around us. So I guess I do see those two themes as linked, and, you know, that maybe we get back a piece of our authenticity, you know, when we're again in possession of a nervous system that can move up and down, and activation and settling, and, you know, that wave-like motion of expansion and contraction. That's very slime moldy too, I think.
I think that brings up a really great point. And I really want to go back to something Amber brought up again, with the idea of maybe we're using the word trauma when we might mean an intense grief and loss. And I'm wondering, based on Joshua's definition of resilience, how can we build resilience in environmental activists, researchers, and other vulnerable populations that are trying to do this work? I know as a researcher, it can be draining and overwhelming. And I think there's others that I'm recognizing in the audience today that are in similar fields who would love to hear about that.
Listen is what's coming up for me. It's interesting because I was teaching continuum, and it was a year or two ago, and one of the students in the class is an environmental science educator in Australia, and told me, and it wasn't a surprise, but mentioned it, that the rates of depression and suicidal ideation amongst scientists and people who have seen the data for years in terms of climate change and the consequences of our not tending to the planet. And again, it wasn't surprising, but it was just one of those moments where that really hit me. It just hit me. And I thought of all the times, and this is something I care deeply about. In fact, I was just digging a paper that I wrote like 15 years ago that got rejected from a book. It was a proposal for a chapter about climate change and humanity and how we treated each other. And they were like, oh no, you know, that's like, it was actually dismissed as, you know, that's kind of crazy conjecturing, which, I mean, here we are now. I think of how many times I might have gone, well, that's a ways down the line, or just in the busyness of the world, not really listened. So that's really my response, is I am seeking out more and more of those people who are doing that work and creating the data and really understand it and listening and reading and going to their talks. I guess that's the activist in me. Like, a simple activist action is just to show up and listen.
This question's sitting hard with me, like, because there's no easy answer, right? There's no like, oh, do this and it'll all be good. It takes me into the darkness. It takes me into the piece of like, we're all gonna die, every one of us. And sometimes like I have to, for myself, actually frame, like, if we knock ourselves off this planet, what if that's okay? Like, can I let go of it? Because the center of at least every meditation system method I've come across that seems worthwhile is to let go. It's just stop trying so hard and then find out what erupts, what just comes bubbling up. And my life has imitated this path. I worked very hard to be an academic and do all the right things. I was very in my, like, I'm so fancy and smart. And then life just kept saying, no, stop it. Stop it. Just be. And like, that's kind of where I find myself now, is this like, oh, just what actually feels good to share, or where, who can I meet from my heart rather than my head? And like, it's starting after like 8 years of practice to work a little bit. And as soon as I grab onto it, it's like, oh. So it's like, I'm so attached to the idea that my son will have a world to grow up in. And I don't know, I'm not in control of it. And so when my genuine, wholehearted motivation tells me to create some action, then I'm following that. And otherwise, I'm pretty much trying to let things go. I mean, there's a great book. It's something like it's about not giving you know what? I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on this station. So it's like, there's only so many these things to give. There's actually very few. So for the most part, we can't give up. And so it's like, what's really coming through? And if I'm a true activist, not an activist, then my activism's going to come out because I can't help it, because I'm so in love. And that's what happens to me with dance. I just manifested this studio at my home a year ago. And it's like, how'd that happen? And it just like, wow, thank you, spirit. And it has something to do with this, just it can't be helped. It is that important. And if it's not that important, then seeing the darkness in ourself of, oh, maybe that's not my truth. Like, I so would love to be political on certain levels. I can't stomach it. It's not important to me. I'd rather dance. That's where I can give. So that's what I got.
You know, I think a lot about how many of us enter into ecological activism or other kinds of, you know, trying to minister to our bruised and battered world, and then, you know, burn out. It's a really challenging endeavor, and there's not always the kind of compassion that we offer to others or to ourselves as we're going through that, that would make it more sustainable. And, you know, part of this, I think, is recognizing that we live in a culture that doesn't equip us with these basic capacities, you know, to be embodied, you know, like, I've now asked the question of, you know, thousands of people in various classes, who amongst us had a caregiver who regularly asked you what you felt in your body? And like, I think two hands have gone up, you know, in like years and years, thousands of human beings, you know, it's just, at least in this Western worldview, you know, it's just not an area that we get any support for. So one of the things that I think about a lot is, you know, in a lot of somatics approaches and somatic experiencing, we have this notion of pendulation, movement back and forth between polarities. A lot of people who show up and really pay attention to, you know, what's happening and try to, you know, make the world a better place, are people who kind of have this ability to hold the negative, you know, aren't inclined to turn away from things that are challenging. And that's a really important capacity. We do need that right now. I mean, we need that all the time. But we also need the other side, you know, and there's tended to be this sort of polarization where there's some people who are like, we all really need to look at this negative thing. And then other people who are like, can we just, like, you know, not do that and maybe focus on things that are more positive? And you've ended up, especially in this culture, with a bias towards positive thinking and, you know, that kind of thing. But I'm really fond of this idea that that we can move back and forth between the two and begin to unite those polarities. And I think in that could be something really beneficial for activists, for researchers, you know, who are sometimes bombarded with negative information, you know, that they could start to, you know, approach this as Adrienne Marie Brown counsels us, as, you know, pleasure activism, you know, like finding ways to really inhabit and augment, you know, this embodied experience of pleasure, comfort, or ease, and, you know, really start to prioritize that as well.
No, I think there's such an important point that you brought up, and I really want to end on this one, I think, before we do some wrap up, is can we speak to how trauma and environment and some of those polarities divide populations and what we can do as activists and researchers to support that?
That's a huge question. Mm-hmm. It's such a big question. I'm again just reflecting on when I've worked in communities that have been at war, Muslim, Christian, or Hutu, Tutsi, and how that. Well, colonial. It's always, you know, colonialism is the perpetrator there. The ways that colonialism has divided up the earth and created geopolitical nation states that have nothing to do with landscape or true tribal movements. I'm going to answer this really simply because it's such a huge question and I know we don't have a lot of time, but I know one of the things that has been helpful in those contexts, both to work with the communities, no magic, no miracle. People don't always come back together easily after that level of violence. But also the impact of violence on the earth, which is, you know, the impact of violence on our own body. That's when I do a lot of rhythmic work. I do a lot of work with rhythm and connecting, and this is a really shortcut answer, earth rhythms. This is where a lot of movement and dance comes in how I work. I'm very connected to the Haitian tradition, spiritual tradition. I'm a Sevito, so a lot of bringing in the aspects of ritual and dance, rhythm, in very different ways, always adapted for the culture that I'm working in, always listening to how that might be part of their natural way of being. And I have found that that can be very helpful, not always immediately. In fact, I received an email about 18 years after I'd been in a community that was divided by war from a young man who said, I kept using those rhythm practices and talking about how beautifully it was bringing generations together, young and old, in his community, and continuing to integrate after all of that segregation.
Thank you. Yeah. I keep being moved and I don't because it feels awkward or something, but I just want to thank you, Amber, for doing that work, showing up in those places and offering your presence. And you know, and specifically to your question, Alicia, you know, one of the things that I keep in mind is that, you know, to have an ecological worldview is not really a political thing, you know, and this great polarization that we have, like here in the United States, but, you know, I think it obtains in other places as well, where there's like, you know, these political divisions, you know, the effort to protect the earth, to protect human futures, you know, that's not really a political issue, or at least it shouldn't be. And for sure, I think possible to elicit a shared affirmation of the importance of that, regardless of political outlook and how that might tend to polarize people.
Part of the question as I heard it was this, what does trauma do to our ability to relate to each other? And I heard it on the mass level, and I think that's more than I can even grasp to answer, except to say that we become divided when we can't witness each other as we are. Like, a big piece of dancing together is to be able to witness each other, to be witnessed, to allow myself to be seen, to allow myself to see you for even a split second before I put my judgment on you, because it's going to happen. No matter how hard I try to avoid it. The thing is, what do I do when that judgment falls? I go, oh, there I am judging. When there's a lot of trauma, which I'm going to frame in this, I mean, trauma has so many T's, which in this point I'm going to frame as like, I go into a reflexive pattern, then I may not be able to notice that mirror. And then I'm reacting to what it is I'm putting on you as much as I'm reacting to or responding to or allowing space for what you're actually communicating to me, whoever you are. And so for me, what do we do about it? It's like the more sides, the more edges of this container, and not just the physical, but the metaphysical, the consciousness container that moves and feels in so many ways, the more sides of that, the more diverse I can be in my experience of that, and thereby resilient to new, you know, different pressures, then there's the chance of my being able to see you, whoever you are, everybody, one, many, different races, different genders, different, whatever that is. And I think this is being pushed harder than ever right now as we're all here on screen, because it's much harder to do on a screen than it is with an actual human being. And so now we're really putting it to the test. And all these narratives about shouldn't be together, could we be together, or whatever that is, like, there's a lot going on around that. Are we really dangerous to each other? Big question. We all have an opinion.
I think there's so many big questions that we still could ask, and there's so much I want to ask you, and I'm sure the audience as well. So Gabby has put all of the links to our fabulous presenters in the chat as well. If you're looking for deeper connection, we do have coffee breaks. They are virtual. Really great opportunity to talk to others about what you've experienced here in this session and what others have experienced throughout their day too. You can also buy the package. So we do have a full library available, whether you're looking specifically here in the Ecology and Research Channel and are channeling and working on your activism. I think the library is a lifelong resource to go back to, especially some of the talks just like this that we've had throughout the course of this whole conference so far. And there's so many more to come. Before I get back to our incredible panel with one last question, I will let folks know if you're looking for what's next here on the Ecology and Research Channel, we do have a speaker, Fern Schaefer, who's going to be talking about performance and ritual work. So you won't want to miss that directly after this. So one final question, folks. Please just give us one word, your top tip for embodiment.
Who's going first? I'll go. Get down on the ground. Find the time, find the space. That's it.
I'll say it again. Listen.
Gosh, you said you were going to do this, and I thought about it, and it's still so hard. One word. Heart.
Yeah. I have so much gratitude for the three of you for joining in and giving this incredible panel and the space for everyone's questions. We appreciate you from all of us at the Ecology Research Channel and the whole conference. I can't wait for more folks, especially those in time zones where it's very early in the morning for them, so the 2-3 a.m. time zone, to wake up and watch this session and gain all the incredible information. So thank you, all three of you, so much again.
Thank you.
Amazing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Gabby.